Come Again, Sexuality and Orgasm is my solution-driven limited series podcast to get your libido to kick in and your clitoral nerve endings to wake up. You can find Come Again on drstriker.substack.com. Any midlife woman knows that once you hit your 40s, 50s, 60s, things will not go well if you eat the same way you did when you were 20, which for me would be an entire box of Wheat Thins, preferably covered with massive amounts of melted cheese. And most women figure out how to eat in their 30s and 40s to stay reasonably healthy. But that all changes when perimenopause hits. In this episode, I'll be chatting with an expert in postmenopause nutrition with a focus on food, not fads. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause midlife and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. I Googled optimal nutrition for menopausal women. Huge mistake. Not only did I get conflicting information on the appropriate amount of fats, carbs, protein, and calories, but I also immediately got inundated with ads for supplements that evidently every postmenopause woman needs to buy. No wonder women are confused. So I decided to bring in an expert to sort out the conflicting information, and the first person I thought of was Dr. Alexandra Filangieri. Alexandra Filangieri has a doctorate in clinical nutrition with a focus on evidence-based nutrition interventions, particularly in midlife and menopause. I heard her speak at a symposium on menopause where I was also speaking, and I was blown away by not only her depth of knowledge, but also her common sense approach to helping women navigate the healthiest way to eat for the second half of their life, including how to hit the grocery store. So welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It was such a great talk you gave in Dallas, and I took notes, a lot of notes. Yeah. All right, so I'm going to divide this into two parts.
Okay.
First, I want to talk about what changes postmenopause, and then I want to get practical, really practical, what to eat, how much to eat, and practical tips so someone isn't walking around with a calculator all day to keep track of carbs and protein. And I also asked my Substack followers to submit questions, so I'll be throwing them in as we go. But I want to start with this. Estrogen has a positive impact on metabolism. We know that. What changes postmenopause when estrogen plummets?
I think that's a really good question. And I'm going to start by saying, I think as someone working with these patients, it's super important to have an evidence-based and solid understanding. So I like to divide estrogen's role in the body into a few different categories. First, the central nervous system. Second, skeletal muscle. Third, adipose tissue and fat cells. And then fourth, the liver. So first, understanding that there are estrogen receptors in all of these places. And with the loss of estrogen, there is going to be a change. So the central nervous system, I would say, is by far the most complex, and I will save that for the end. But just starting with skeletal muscle, when we eat carbohydrates. They absorb into our bloodstream as sugar. And the role of insulin is to help bring sugar into our cells. Something that we see at the level of the skeletal muscle is that with insulin resistance and the loss of estrogen, we're not bringing sugar into the cells at the same rate that we would if we did not have insulin resistance. So that's the first factor. The second factor is estrogen influences fat cells. So with the loss of estrogen, we see changes in lipogenesis or in the way we are processing, storing, and where we are storing fats.
Let me just interrupt because I have a question. When you say lipogenesis, can you define lipogenesis?
Yes. So the way I like to think about it is how we are taking our food substrates and then storing them as fat cells.
So making fat, essentially.
Yeah, essentially.
Just to make it really simple. How do people get fat? Where do we get that extra fat from? How do we make fat? That's what lipogenesis is.
Yes, right? Yes. Okay. And then, you know, the lever of the liver, which is more complex, but essentially how our liver releases sugar into our bloodstream and how that changes. And then the most interesting part is the central nervous system. So And like I said, I'm not going to claim to be an expert on this pathway, but I think it's really interesting to see that there are estrogen receptors in the hypothalamic region in the brain. And they're in this region, we also see a response to things like hunger hormones and fullness, right? So the research that I've seen, one is predominantly in animals and mice, but seeing that with the loss of estrogen, there can be an increase in food intake. So can we apply this totally to people? I'm not necessarily saying yes, but just understanding that estrogen will have a specific role in different parts of the body, essentially in, as we know, how we are storing fats, how we are processing sugar, and how our brain may be responding to food intake.
You know, I think that that's such an important point, because when we think about nutrition and when we think about being hungry, we really think of it at the level of the gut, which is very important. We're going to get to that. But at the end of the day, this is all centrally controlled in the brain. And as you said, that all important hypothalamus that, you know, when we look at pleasure centers in the brain, you know, I talk so much about sexuality, and it's so interesting that a lot of the stuff that is controlling sexuality is also controlling our desire to eat. And in a weird kind of way, and no one really thinks of it this way, but when our sex drive goes down, for some people, this also has an impact, not a good impact necessarily, on our desire to eat food. You know, it's really, as you said, estrogen receptors in the brain impact a very big picture.
Something that I've seen with my patients is just the phenomenon of I'm craving sugar. Yeah. And I find it to be interesting. And, you know, I don't want to directly correlate that with the loss of estrogen, because I haven't seen, you know, extremely strong data on it. But understanding that with the loss of estrogen, there is going to be a change on things like food cravings and appetite.
No, that's exactly the point, is some people who were never big sweets people, all of a sudden, sugar becomes a big issue. And on the topic of sugar, I was going to save that, but since you brought it up, there was a question that came in about sugar, which I'm going to throw at you now. Someone wanted to know about belly fat and sugar. And let me just scroll down to this person's question. This is from Allison. And she wanted to know, does reducing sugars to less than 25 milligrams a day really help fight belly fat? And why are added sugars different than natural sugars like found in fruit?
Good question. And I think the first thing to know, right, is that with the menopause transition, the accumulation of visceral fat is a physiologic pathway that happens.
Mm-hmm. So I think can you please, for those who aren't familiar with this, please define visceral fat.
So, and I want to define this in a, in a correct way. Like, it's not the subcutaneous fat, it's the fat that sits in more internal to the organs.
Surrounding the organs, you know, the stuff you don't see. We all see the stuff on our hips, we all see the stuff on our belly, but we don't see the fat that is inside surrounding our organs.
Yeah. So I think understanding that part of that shift is naturally occurring and a part of the hormonal shift that happens during menopause is important. When it comes to sugar, it's important to know that too much of anything is not good. So is 25 the magic number that if you eat less than 25 grams of sugar per day, that you're not going to develop visceral fat? I can't necessarily say that. Something that we do know with higher sugar diets, essentially, if we don't use it, we store it. And I think that that's a really important factor. Now, you asked, what is the difference between naturally occurring sugar and added sugar? Sugar is found in fruits, vegetables, carbohydrates. Essentially, sugar is glucose molecules. So if you eat a slice of bread, you're eating sugar because your body is going to break that bread down into glucose molecules or sugar. Now, when you're eating whole food sources of carbohydrates, you're also getting fiber. So when you're absorbing whole food sources of carbohydrates, you're not getting as much sugar as if you were to eat a product that has, let's say, carbohydrates and added sugar. Added sugar has no fiber. And when we eat it, we will absorb it relatively quick into our body. So I do think that reducing or being mindful of sugar intake is important. And it really comes to flipping the product around, looking at the nutrition label and seeing what is in this. Is this product high in carbohydrates? Is this product high in added sugar? Is this product high in a combination of carbohydrates and added sugar?
Yeah, I think one of the places I always got fooled was salad dressing. You always think of a vinaigrette salad dressing as being healthy. And then I started looking at the bottle and I was floored by how much sugar was in some of these bottled salad dressings, and it's just better to make your own. But the other part of the question was about belly fat. And, you know, we talk about the visceral fat that you can't see. Well, what people are dealing with is they can't button their jeans anymore because suddenly they have belly fat, even if the scale didn't change. And I think it's really important to mention that that there's a redistribution of fat on the outside, you know, more of that hip fat, more of that belly fat, even if you never had it before. And so going back to the impact of menopause on nutrition, I want to talk about hot flashes and sleep deprivation for a little bit, because we know that that impacts metabolism and weight and hot flashes. I mean, 80% of women have hot flashes, and we know that hot flashes are associated with being overweight, but we also know this is bidirectional. You know, being obese increases hot flashes, but hot flashes make it difficult to lose weight because of those surges in cortisol and not sleeping and all that. So how do you approach this with your clients when they come in and they're perimenopause and they're flashing all day, all night? What do you tell them?
It's super important. It's super important to not be ignored. And I think as the role of the registered dietitian is understanding that you need to understand when you need to get your physician friend on board, right? So having the patient have comprehensive care so that if they need support for their hot flashes or sleep disturbances, and that comes in the form of hormones, that they're working with the provider that can do so for them. Now, when we put it back into the role of the registered dietitian, yes, we do see with weight that there is, you know, increased prevalence of hot flashes. So talking about the fact that weight loss may be favorable in this time period. Now, I am talking about sustainable, adequate nutrition, exercise. I am talking about sustainable weight loss, not let's reduce your calories. Let's have you eat basically nothing and hope that you lose weight. So first off, it's the conversation around weight loss. If they can benefit from weight loss, that I think it's totally within the realm of the registered dietitian to have an honest conversation and to counsel them on how weight loss may be important at this time in their life. Now, I've also seen correlational data, right? So it's not causation, that diets that are high in ultra processed foods, high in sugar, high in energy, high in calories can contribute to the severity of hot flashes. So it's correlational, meaning that I'm not saying that these ultra processed diets cause hot flashes. But we also know at this time in life that these ultra processed diets, high in fat, high in sugar, are not favorable from a health perspective.
Right. I mean, I think it's very clear that an ultra processed diet is not good for anything. Yeah. We can tick off a lot of boxes. And certainly one of the reasons why women have a difficult time losing weight with hot flashes is because of the inflammatory reaction that occurs every time there is a hot flash, and processed food's not going to help that. But I'm going to push you on this a little bit, because I think that too often women are not really told about the impact of hot flashes on their ability to lose weight. And you know, obviously, you're not going to be the one that's going to prescribe hormone therapy or is going to tell them about the non-hormonal options that they have to get rid of these hot flashes. But as a dietitian, don't you think that you should be pushing a little bit and saying to these women, look, you are flashing all day. You can have a perfect diet. You can do everything I tell you to do. But until you do something about those hot flashes, this is going to be an uphill battle. And in fact, if they have a clinician who is not a menopause expert and is not helping them, do you ever just say, hey, maybe you should get another opinion from someone who does have some expertise in this?
Yeah. And I think that that's why being well-versed in complete menopause care is super important, because when they get that comment of you don't need this, or, you know, hormone therapy isn't beneficial for you, I can say, well, I understand that that may be the experience that you have with one provider, but I'm very happy to refer you to somebody else. Yeah. Something else that I talk about with my patients, and I say realistically, like, this is a challenging time in midlife for women. I always say, if the sky is falling, how are you going to eat that day? And what does this mean? It puts a little bit of responsibility back onto the patient. And I am not talking about complex nutrition, right? But understanding that if it's a good day, if it's a bad day, if it's a tired day, if it's an energized day, what are the four things that I can do that can help me feel better? And I am not talking about complex things. I am talking about, you have simple breakfast that is protein rich in the fridge that is going to take you 2 minutes to prepare. You have a few frozen foods that you can combine with fresh foods, and now you have a fiber and protein rich meal. You have simple snack options that you can pick that are going to bring you closer towards your goal. So I think saying that, you know, of course they're not feeling their best and they need to treat the hot flashes, but also in that time period, without pushing them to a place that they're uncomfortable, giving them the resources that are super individualized to their life. At least they have resources.
Yeah. And I do want to get to some of those specific tips, but before we leave the whole hot flash thing, I also want to focus for a minute on sleep, because you did throw out there about sleep, and we know that sleep is important, and we know that perimenopause women generally don't sleep. And it's not just the hot flashes. It's the aches and pains. It's the sleep apnea. It's the snore in the bed. It's all that stuff. But what I'd like you to spend a few minutes talking about is specifically how inadequate sleep and poor sleep impacts metabolism and nutrition in kind of a big picture.
Yeah. So with poor sleep, of course, we're going to have poor energy. We're also going to have increased food cravings. So understanding that that is, you know, prevalent is going to be extremely important. So what I haven't seen is specific data showing that, you know, changes in metabolism directly related to sleep, but I do see decreased energy expenditure because the patient is tired and they're not feeling well, and they cannot expend the energy that they could if they were well rested. Right? Constantly not having energy to prepare groceries, not having energy to fuel and feed themselves properly. So I'm not sure if I directly answered your question.
No, you did. And yeah. And I think one of the things also that I read about is women who have an inadequate sleep tend to make bad food choices. If you're exhausted and you have mm-hmm. the choice between the box of Triscuits with cheese versus making a healthy salad, you're going to go with the box of Triscuits with cheese.
There is information on things like night shift nurses and truck drivers overnight showing that just the altered sleep patterns really do influence their daytime food consumption.
And nighttime, I'm just saying, as someone who spent many, 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 many nights up in labor and delivery all night, I can tell you that at 2 o'clock in the morning when someone ordered their pizza, we went at it like we'd, you know, been in the desert for a month. I mean, it just, and that's something that I normally would not sit there and like eat an entire pizza. Yeah. So it's the exhaustion. It's feeling kind of sorry for yourself. It's all of that. Let me ask you this question, because I've never really gotten an answer on this. There was a study that came back a few years ago that said that metabolism doesn't really start to slow down until age 60. But we've also just been talking about how menopause changes metabolism. So that seems conflicting to me. So is your metabolic rate more dependent on aging? Is it dependent on hormones? Or you're saying it's both? What's the science?
So the science pinpoints that lean mass and muscle mass is going to be the biggest driver of metabolic rate as we age. Essentially, with aging, there's more of a likelihood of developing sarcopenia or having decreased muscle mass if we are not being proactive and preventative about preserving our muscle mass. So that's
how do we do that?
Yeah, good question. So how do we preserve or increase our muscle mass as we age? There's two factors. Actually, there's three factors that we have to look at. The first is resistance training. Resistance training is not fat. It is something that is super essential for women, and it's super essential for women for a few factors. One, it's going to be, of course, the health of our bones. And second, it's going to be the health of our muscles. So if we are not actively trying to gain muscle and feeding our muscles with protein, which I know is something that we're definitely going to talk about, then we are putting ourselves at risk of losing muscle mass. So I would like to go into that in detail, but I want to also address the any energy expenditure and hormones question. Now, I can simply say that we do not have strong data. So I would like to see strong data. I would love to see a research study published that looks at the influence of estrogen on metabolic rate. But I haven't seen anything just yet. We do know that estrogen influences the brain. We do know that it can influence food intake. Now, does it influence energy expenditure alongside food intake? That's something that I haven't seen any strong data on just yet, but I'm hoping in the future, as we put more emphasis on women's health and research, that we can get to an answer.
Well, we're not going to see that anytime soon. Don't get started. In fact, we're seeing quite the opposite.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the energy expenditure thing a little bit. When you gave the lecture in Dallas, you had a really nice slide that divided up how we expend energy. So can you go through that?
Yes. And this was fascinating to me. And it was the reason that I decided to talk about it, because people don't really understand energy expenditure. And I understand why, because it can be a little bit, you know, complex. But the first part of our energy expenditure is our resting metabolic rate. And that is just the calories that our body consumes in a rested state. Essentially, you wake up in the morning, you haven't eaten, you haven't exercised. How many calories does our body need at baseline? Resting metabolic rate is going to be influenced by our muscle. How much lean muscle mass do we have? Something that we know at baseline is muscle will burn more energy daily than fat mass. So when it comes to our resting metabolic rate, having more muscle mass is going to increase our resting metabolic rate. Then there are other factors.
I have a question before you go on. Don't lose that thought, but I do have a question because I want to pull together. You talked about the importance of resistance training and about how having more lean muscle is going to help you burn more energy. So is it the training itself, or is it that you're getting more lean muscle that is going to help in terms of your metabolic rate?
So it's actually going to dip into two different categories. So when it comes to your metabolic rate, it is, or your basal metabolism, your resting metabolism, that's going to be putting on muscle and how much muscle you have on board. Mm-hmm. When you start to look into the other categories, such as your physical activity, which is another factor. So we have our resting energy expenditure, and then we add our physical activity. Now, this one, especially population-wide, is much more variable. Right? Some people have a lot of physical activity, others do not, right? So we are going to tack on our resting energy expenditure plus the calories that we are expending and burning with physical activity. There are two other factors that we'll take into our daily energy expenditure. This one is small, but it's worth noting: the thermic effect of food. Essentially, it takes calories to digest the food that we're eating. Something that we do know is protein has to be broken down a little further than carbohydrates and fats. Protein has nitrogen on it. We must remove the nitrogen from the protein. That requires calories. So protein has a higher thermic effect or requires more calories than carbohydrates and fats. So eating protein evenly spaced throughout the day will slightly raise our total daily energy expenditure. Now, the final category that's definitely worth talking about is, so we talked about resting energy expenditure. We talked about physical activity. We talked about the thermic effect of food. Finally, our activities of daily living, or I believe it's referenced as non-exercise thermogenesis. The calories that it takes us to get up, to take our dog for a walk, to get to the office, to clean our house, to do laundry. So these are just calories that we're expending in daily living that isn't necessarily exercise. So what has changed from a population level? We're more sedentary. We are working more desk jobs. We are commuting less. We're getting our groceries delivered to our home. So we are expending less energy in the first place, just in our activities of daily living. So once you take your resting metabolic rate, the thermic effect of food, physical activity, and the activities of daily living, you combine all these things together, then you essentially get a number of how many calories are you consuming daily?
I read an article that was just published last week, so you probably haven't seen it yet. I was doing it on the news in Chicago where I do general medical stuff. And it was an article that was looking at the size of bites that somebody takes. And one of the things that they said in this article was that if you take small bites, that it actually gets digested better and more enzymes at work, and you end up getting a bigger benefit from what you're eating. So how does that sit with you, given what you just said, when we're looking at the energy that you expend just from digesting food? Does it then follow that if you eat your food slowly, and if you take little bites, and if you chew it really well, that you're actually going to have more energy expended? Or am I just making that up?
So, I mean, I like to think of just like presence at mealtimes, right? When we're eating in super fast mode, we are bypassing our fullness signals. We are bypassing any attention that we can have with the meal. So, I mean, is it possible that, like, you know, we're chewing more and like we're, you know, expending more calories doing so? But I really like to highlight more the fact of we have to be present if we can at our mealtime, because it allows us to check in with our hunger and our fullness signals that otherwise we can totally override, especially, you know, you're in the car, you're at your desk, there's way less intention. And when there's less intention, then we tend to overdo it.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt. And I totally agree with that. And I think we have a lot of data that talks about that, about allowing your brain to catch up with your belly to say, stop already, you've had enough to eat. So that eating slowly and with intention and not putting food in your mouth when you already have food in your mouth, you know, wait until your mouth is empty to take the next bite, all of that. But I just thought this whole idea of digesting in smaller amounts was kind of interesting, just in terms of getting more bang for your buck, if you will, you know, getting better nutrition, better digestion, and maybe, and like I said, I'm just making this up, that you're actually spending more energy to digest it because you're digesting it in smaller pieces. But just a thought. I thought I'd throw that out there. But so before we leave this topic, I have another question for you. Is if you want to take that circle graph that you showed in Dallas and you divide it up, just give some rough percentages, understanding that everyone is different, but just how much of this is your basal metabolic energy expenditure? How much is your activity? How much, you know what I mean? How would you divide it into terms of importance?
Yeah. So 60 to 70% is your resting energy expenditure.
Did you say 6 to 7 or 60 to 70?
60 to 70%.
That's huge.
Yeah. So that is, you know, the calories that our bodies require daily just to maintain our normal functionings. And it's hard for me to give numbers above resting energy expenditure because it's really going to be variable per person. Yeah. Exercise is, of course, the one that can be the most variable, depending on how much the person is going to do, as well as their activities of daily living, how much energy that they're going to consume there. I would say the thermic effect of food is probably the smallest one. Yeah. So it's super not insignificant, but the one that's going to have the least amount of impact. I wouldn't say to somebody, if you want to really increase your energy expenditure, you should really just focus on how you're eating, because I think it would have the least impact compared to physical activity and activities of daily living on top of their resting energy expenditure.
Yeah, there was a question that came in about hydration from a Substack reader. What was that? It was about, you know, why is it so important to hydrate? Is it important? And if so, why and how much?
Yeah, good question. So there is a good paper, and it's a review article looking at nutrition and perimenopause and menopause. And it was the first one that actually gave a specific amount for fluids. And what they say is 33 mLs per kg. So milliliters per kg body weight. And to put that into, I guess, regular people.
Yeah, someone who weighs 140 pounds, what should they be drinking?
So, I mean, 80, 90 ounces, 100 ounces of water a day.
Does coffee count?
Technically, yes. Technically, yes. And we want to think of hydration in a few different areas. So, of course, it is extremely important for the digestive process. You know, making sure that we have adequate fluid, especially if we're going to focus on fiber. And I know we're going to go into detail about the food piece, but if we're having adequate fiber, we need adequate fluid. We need adequate fluid for physical activity. And then we need adequate fluid for general baseline energy. Dehydration just does not feel well in general. Yeah. So we don't really want to factor in low energy, maybe from what's going on internally with a dehydrated body. Now, this is actually a question that you may know more on than me, but, you know, I've seen that hormonal fluctuations may impact thirst, and I don't have a solid answer for that. But if that's the case, and I know with age, and I've definitely seen this in the elderly population, I worked in a nursing home before I started my private practice, is that thirst mechanism decreases with age. So if we know thirst mechanism decreases, hydration is super important for things like energy, digestion. Yeah. Then it's inevitable that we need to increase and prioritize our hydration.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the one thing I would add to that is that for women who are having hot flashes, they're losing fluid. You know, when you're sweating like crazy and then you get the chills and the energy of all of that is that I'm not saying that if you hydrate, you're going to have less hot flashes. You are not. But right. I am saying that if you're having hot flashes, then you have to even be more careful about hydration. All right. I want to get to some of these specific food groups because I think that that's what's so confusing about everyone to everyone. So let's talk about, I want to start with fiber because you mentioned fiber and there was a question that came in from Kim saying, I really need to understand fiber better, what it does, why, and the role of the fiber in gut microbiome, and also why it is suddenly so important in midlife, or is it? So there's a lot there. I'll let you just go with it.
So the first thing that we need to know is that fiber has been important. It is important at every stage of our lifetime. And it is one of those nutrients that in general, if we look at the American diet, we're not getting enough fiber in. Now, let's first start with what is fiber? Fiber is naturally found in things like fruits and vegetables and whole grains. That's where we get fiber from our food system. And what is fiber's role in our body? It's going to do a few things. The first is digestion. If we don't have adequate fiber inside of our colon, we are not going to have regular bowel movements. So we really do want to focus on fiber. The second piece there is fiber diversity. What is fiber diversity? Inside of the large intestine, it's not a sterile environment, meaning that there are multiple different microbes, bacteria, beneficial and non-beneficial bacteria. We know when you eat more fiber, you are promoting more beneficial microbes and beneficial bacteria. Now, there's so much research on the gut looking at the role of a healthy gut microbiome in things like food cravings, mental and emotional health, obesity, and so on.
Even cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just attended the Obesity Congress in Spain, and there was a lot of discussion on the role that the gut microbiome has in weight and weight regulation, which is extremely fascinating. So what does a perimenopausal, menopausal woman need to know? This is where it's going to get really applied. I'm going to generalize, but I've looked at a lot of the data to do so. One cup of fiber, and I'm talking about a dry measuring cup of a vegetable, is going to contain around 5 grams of fiber. So this is why I say, if we are trying to hit our minimum 28 to 30 grams of fiber a day, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 for five. You're going to have 4 cups of vegetables and 1 cup of fruit per day. When it comes to different sources of fiber, right? Do we want our body just to get one type or one promote one microbe or one type of fiber? No. So you're looking for diversity. You're going to change up the types of fiber. that you're giving your body. Because why? It's better for digestion. It's going to support the gut microbiome. It's going to contribute to fullness. We know that vegetables are volume-rich foods. You can eat a lot of them, and they don't have a lot of calories. So when it comes to fiber, I would say it's not an overrated nutrient. We most likely don't get enough of it. And you do have to understand that you need to eat your cups of vegetables a day to meet your baseline fiber needs.
When you say vegetable, does that also include lettuce? Because people, I think 4 cups, and that seems like a lot. But if you get in the habit of having a salad right there, that can be easily 2, 3, or even 4 cups, right?
Yeah. I'm fine with lettuce. I know it gets such a bad rap, but if you look at the nutrients in it, it's just fine. You make a salad, you have your berries in the morning, you make a salad with 2 cups of veggies, you roast your veggies and you put it with your protein at night. You've easily gotten your 4 cups of veggies. Yeah. And you haven't really even put too much thought into it. I typically don't recommend fiber supplements until the diet can meet by food.
Right. Okay. You brought up supplements. Let's go down that rabbit hole. Yeah. We just have to go there with protein. I'm not even going to say anything. Talk about protein, talk about supplements.
So you're going to get more satiety from real food sources of protein. And I think what we have in this country is actually an education gap on protein. So, and I always use my hand when I'm counseling my patients. If you look at around your palm size, that's going to give you around 20 grams of protein. That is not a lot of protein to eat from food sources. So I'm going to always take a food first approach with protein. Why? Because it's going to contribute to fullness. Now, where do supplements have their role? If the person cannot meet their protein needs by real food, then some supplementation may be fine. So where do I see this? Patients that are on weight loss medications that are struggling to meet their protein needs, somebody with a busy lifestyle that may be able to add a protein supplement in post-gym. But I think that understanding that we can't rely on protein supplements, we need to learn how to rely on food first. And then if we have to fill the gap, we can fill the gap.
Aside from feeling full, is there any downside to using a protein supplement? I mean, I never have, and I've never told anybody to, but they sure are popular. So there's the fullness thing I get. But that aside, is there any advantage or disadvantage to using a protein supplement versus food?
So the advantage, especially with using something like a whey protein, is they're rich in an amino acid called leucine. Leucine is an amino acid that helps stimulate the muscle protein synthesis pathway. So we know we need leucine on deck when we're building muscle. So that would definitely be an advantage. And I would say just a disadvantage is the market is so saturated with proteins that oftentimes now we're getting protein plus 1,000 other things that we don't necessarily need for our body. So it's really going to come to, I guess, the formula of the protein powder. I don't necessarily think that it's the worst thing, but I think that it shouldn't be a crutch. We should really learn how to eat before supplementation, unless there are reasons such as a restrictive diet where protein can be,
Yeah. And if you're talking about a palmful of protein a day,
not a lot.
It's not a lot. That's not difficult to do. I mean, I think certainly for people who are vegan, that they have to be a little bit more mindful in terms of getting that protein, but there's so many good sources of protein.
I'd actually like to give you an example if I can. So for example, if you're going to have, let's say we'll use like a serving of cottage cheese in the morning, that's 20 grams of protein, right? If you're don't eat lactose, maybe you eat eggs. One egg is 6 grams. So if you combine 2 eggs and 2 egg whites, you're at 20 grams of protein. If you have 4 ounces of lean protein at lunch, you could have between 20 to 30 grams. And same thing, if you have 5 ounces at dinner, that's 30. So we're already at 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 grams of protein a day. Let's say we throw in a small snack that's like a Greek yogurt or like edamame or maybe a bar or something of that sort. You're getting close to 100 grams of protein. So I think what we need before supplementation is we need education on how to use your food sources to get the amount of protein you need for your body.
Yeah, no, that's so important. And I think it is confusing because of all the ads that do pop up. It seems to be these protein supplements. So food aside, understanding that that's the basic approach. But if someone is going to take a protein supplement, what should they look for? What should they avoid?
So I'm a simplicity approach type of person. So realistically, we have to understand, especially like in this midlife phase, calories do matter. So usually I like to say for protein supplements, keeping it less than 200 calories is important. Keeping carbohydrates and added sugar, which we had spoken about, as low as possible. You do not need added sugar in your protein. And then keeping the protein amount between 20 to 30 grams of protein. Usually, if you cannot pronounce it, it is an ingredient that you most likely is not an essential nutrient that you need. So one, simplicity. Two, 20 to 30 grams of protein. Three, low in carbohydrates and added sugar, I would say, is the roadmap I would take if choosing a protein supplement.
Yeah, you threw out whey protein. Can you expand on the benefit of whey protein as opposed to non-whey protein?
So the benefit of whey protein is going to come down to that amino acid leucine that is high in whey protein that we know stimulates muscle protein synthesis. Now, if someone doesn't tolerate whey protein, then they can choose an additional plant-based protein, a soy protein, a rice protein, a pea protein if needed. I typically start with a lactose-free whey protein unless then they cannot digest it properly without, you know, any discomfort, then I would switch to a plant-based protein.
Okay. So, but you do overall recommend a whey protein as the way to go as long as someone doesn't have problems digesting it.
Yes.
Correct. All right. One of the things that you talked about in Dallas was saying, okay, if you're meeting with a client and they're kind of overwhelmed with all this information, and it can be overwhelming because we haven't even touched on a lot of other things, you encourage them to set one nutritional goal to start with. So if you were to recommend one nutritional goal for a midlife woman, what would it be? And it's okay to say there isn't, it depends on, you know, because you did also talk about personalized nutrition. I want to be clear about that.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of like people say, which hormone therapy should I take? And I'm like, are you kidding? You know, there's 4,000 different options and I need to know a lot about you before I tell you which one, because this is personalized. And you make a big point of saying that from a scientific basis, which is how you work, that nutrition and nutrition plans are also personalized. So it is perfectly fair to say that's a terrible question. I can't tell you the answer to that.
You know, one thing I say in every session that I have, independent of how we're going to get there, is meal timing and consistency is the most important thing. And what I mean by that is you're eating regularly, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and you're eating them within, you know, I don't want to say normal, but, you know, a more consistent basis. So for example, I will have someone that will come to me and they'll say, I do not eat breakfast, but then I overeat lunch and dinner. Or I'm noticing that I'm eating all of my calories really late at night. So the first thing I do with most patients is I drag their eating and their snacking out of the nighttime into the daytime. And I help them develop a consistent breakfast, lunch, and dinner time. Now,
you're not a fan of intermittent fasting from what you're saying.
No, no, I'm not. Because I mean, if we factor in just like in general, okay, we've talked about like how a woman is feeling, right? She may not be sleeping. She may not necessarily be feeling as good as she possibly can until she meets a doctor like you, right? But let's now factor the fact that you're not sleeping now. You also aren't going to eat until the middle of the day. Now, we're not even just talking about like the metabolism there. It's just like, it's not practical for a woman to do.
Yeah, no, it's not. And we always talk about how the best diet is a diet that you can sustain, because this isn't something you're going to do for a couple of weeks. This is a lifetime thing. But the intermittent fasting, I mean, we could have a whole discussion on that, of course. And there was a recent article that I had reviewed that was quite interesting. It was specifically intermittent fasting in menopause and perimenopausal women. And I have the details of that on my Substack. I have a whole article looking at it. I mean, looking at this study. And one of the things they said in this study, to your point, is that when you look in terms of maintaining a healthy weight or weight loss, the intermittent fasting and just a calorie controlled diet came out the same. But what was interesting is that some of the metabolic factors, looking at cholesterol levels and all of that, did seem to do better in midlife women on intermittent fasting. So I think the jury is still out on that, but certainly your point is well taken, is you have to do something that you can keep up with, you know, that you, it's not something you just do for a couple of weeks. And this whole idea of not eating until noon is highly problematic, because then you see food and not only do you eat a lot, but you eat fast, which is the other thing that we talked about, which is a problem. All right. I'm going to give you a little scenario here. All right. A couple weeks ago, I interviewed Dr. Annie Fenn about foods that are neuroprotective, and I challenged her to put 10 things and only 10 things in her grocery basket that would protect the brain. So I'm not going to ask you to do that, but I am going to ask you for some best strategies when it comes to shopping. So here's your challenge, a little different than Dr. Fenn's. You're too young to remember this, but there was a TV game show around 20 years ago called Supermarket Sweep. And the contestants had 1 minute and 30 seconds to fill their grocery cart with the most expensive items. So I'm going to switch it up and tell you that you have 1 minute and 30 seconds to shop and to put the best foods to eat during menopause in your cart. So what's your strategy?
Yeah. So, you know what? I think I can actually answer this question in less than a minute and 30 seconds. But this is my strategy with grocery store. And you've heard, right? Shop the perimeter. We're going to take a whole foods approach. And this is what I tell my patients. You're actually going to start with creating a mental list, and you're going to start with breakfast, right? I want you grabbing two foods. So mine would most likely be Greek yogurt and eggs, alongside a fiber source such as berries, which are a great source of antioxidants, and maybe a unsaturated fat like avocado. So I have a protein, a fiber, and a fat, and those would be the ingredients that I would rotate for breakfast. Then when it comes to lunch and dinner, and this is what I tell most of my clients, you are going to grab one frozen protein, one fresh protein, and one shelf stable protein. So let's say the frozen protein for the week is going to be something that can make a stir fry, ground meat. Let's say the fresh protein is going to be something like salmon, which is a wonderful source of omega-3s, which are healthy fat that we know that we want to get in during the stage of life. And then the third, a shelf stable protein is something that's going to be like canned tuna. You can have 30 grams of protein in one can. So now you have three proteins, two are shelf stable, one has to be cooked within the week. Then you're going to look at your vegetables. You are going to grab, I do the same thing, two fresh veggies and two frozen. So mine likely would be a combination of, let's say, broccoli, rice, cauliflower. We're going to look for color. So maybe some frozen peppers for like a fajita mix. And that's going to be my veggies for the week. Then we're going to look at carbohydrates, and carbohydrates with fiber. Canned beans, wonderful option. You can make salads with them. You can throw them into dishes. So I would do most likely canned beans and quinoa as my carbohydrate options. Then we're going to look at fats. I love olive oil. I think it's a great option, or avocado oil. I also love avocado. So those would most likely be my healthy fats. And then if we're trying to look at like the nitty gritty ways to get in nutrients like calcium, and let's say we'll use this for our plant-based friends, I would most likely get tofu that's grown in a calcium medium, because it's an awesome source of calcium and protein. And that would be my staples grocery list. The foods that I would keep in my fridge every single week. So I know that I'm eating my protein, my fiber, I have carbohydrates with fiber, I have calcium, vitamin D, and phosphorus.
Okay. two things I want to say. First of all, I found the best frozen vegetables on earth at Costco. It was a huge bag of roasted vegetables, and I keep them in my freezer, mm-hmm. and they're cut up small. And if I just want to throw frozen vegetables on anything, you know, I could throw it if I'm even making chicken or eggs, and I don't even know the brand name, I should, but I'm just saying, for those Costco shoppers out there, that big bag of roasted vegetables has been a huge time saver for me. But the other thing is, you said really fast at the beginning about shopping the perimeter, because I think That's a concept that you talk about so much that you think everybody knows what you're talking about. Talk about what you mean by shop the perimeter.
Yes. And sometimes I do forget that just because I say this 40 times a day, it doesn't mean that other people hear it 40 times a day. So when you're going to a supermarket, where do the fresh foods lie? And they're going to lie in the produce section, the dairy section, most likely the meat section. And that's usually going to be the outside of the supermarket. So usually when you're getting your grocery staples for the week, you want to walk the outside of the supermarket and pick up those items. Then you want to have a plan for what you're going to get from those aisles inside of the supermarket, right? Because what happens is we end up in snack land and there's 40,000 options. And then we leave with five things that we didn't need, and but we don't have a protein or a veggie that we need for the week. So I'm really big on making a grocery list. I know it can be semi annoying and time consuming, but you know, women have complex and busy lives. So you want to be targeted. You want to go in there and get exactly what you need.
I've actually found that making the grocery list saves me time. I have this app called The List, and I have all my favorites on there. And whenever I use up the last of my olive oil, I immediately just pull out my phone and add it to the list. So I don't have to ever really make the list. And then the best part about it is that if I can get my husband to do the shopping, I can then email him the list and say, while you're there, these are all the things we need. So it's a huge time saver. And I love checking things off my list. So it makes it easy for me. All right, one last topic before we finish this off, because it's so important. And this was a question that came in from Lisa on Substack. And she wants to know about what foods are best for supporting bone health, and can diet help prevent osteoporosis or help if you have osteoporosis? And when we're talking about perimenopausal women, this is when most bone is lost, of course, and it continues postmenopause. And I think that this is something that we should really at least spend a minute or two on. So take it away.
Yeah. I think that the conversation around bone actually needs to start in the 20s instead of the 40s, and maybe even younger. You know, I've worked with a lot of patients with restrictive eating conditions, and they do a lot of damage younger in life when it comes to the health of their bones. So I think first understanding that early in life, if you have restrictive eating, or if you're not meeting your protein, calcium, vitamin D, phosphorus needs, or if you have any condition that's going to cause any type of malabsorption, the conversation needs to happen earlier. I think bones, unfortunately, don't become important. And I'm just talking as someone that is in their 20s, it's not brought up until you're in that perimenopause phase. So I think just really starting the conversation early is really important.
Well, I actually just did an episode on bone with Dr. Risa Kagan. And one of the things we talked about is that women don't have their first bone density until very often in their 60s, which is way too late. And that many women that have low bone mass, it's not so much that they've lost bone, they never got to a healthy bone mass. So there's that. And then they start to lose it. So that is a really important point that you just made.
Yeah. And then I think another factor that becomes important, and we've spoken about resistance training, of course, for women that are in perimenopause and menopause. And you know, from my understanding, like I said, may not necessarily be an expert on this, is but we have to do what we can, understanding that bone loss, you know, part of it is hormonally driven and happens with age. But understanding that loading the bone with resistance training is very important. Now, nutrients that are important for bone. We understand calcium, which is not recommended to supplement unless the diet cannot meet the baseline requirements. Vitamin D, we want to maintain optimal levels. Energy and protein. So is diet going to reverse osteoporosis? No, it's not. So early in life, yes, we need to focus on it. We need to do what we can in the sense of resistance training, having adequate protein, having adequate body weight, not being underweight or overweight, and then keeping those nutrients in mind. That's why you said in my grocery list, like, of course, if I can search for items that are a good source of calcium, vitamin D, phosphorus, protein, I'm going to.
You know, one of the things that this person had said, and as part of her question, was, I have osteoporosis and I did everything right as far as diet. Why do I still have osteoporosis? And the answer, of course, is you are so much better off than if you hadn't done everything right. You know, that it's not going to prevent osteoporosis. It's not going to reverse osteoporosis. But we do know that people that have adequate calcium, vitamin D, weight-bearing exercise are certainly going to impact their bone health. And that I wish I could say that it was 100% preventable with doing all those things, but it's not like you've wasted your time or that it didn't help. Of course it helped, but it just may not be enough depending on genetic factors and other factors, which I think is really the theme of everything we've talked about today, that all of these things are multifactorial. It's not like you can decide one thing to eat or one strategy that is going to give you perfect nutrition and stave off cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis and all the other things that we worry about in the second half of life. But all of these things add up to just put people in a much better starting place. So This has been so helpful. Thank you so much. Is there anything, last words, anything that there's a million things we didn't talk about, but if there's anything that you just feel like you have to get in there before we end.
You know what? You read my mind, because we talked about a lot of things that can be complex, but I think that the biggest take-home message for the person that's listening to this is don't let all of the chatter confuse you from what really is important. Nutrition should not be inaccessible and hard to understand. So what do you really need to focus on? You need to understand that whole foods, vegetables, lean proteins, choosing fiber, right? Reducing your added sugar, reducing your fried foods. These things really can make an impact on our health. And then my approach is always start where you're at. So find one or two things that you feel ready to change. Once you feel good about those changes, tackle the next two things. So don't let anyone make you feel like nutrition is something that is confusing or inaccessible, because at the end of the day, it's the basics that really, really do work.
And as my final note, so often people look for, of course, a menopause expert and a personal trainer. But then when it comes to nutrition, which is equally important, if not more important than those other things, they just kind of rely on whatever information they come across. And I think there is a case to be made for women meeting with an expert, a registered dietitian, who can really guide them from the get-go to maximize the benefit that they're going to get from food and the impact that it's going to have on long-term health. So in the program notes, we will put some information about how to find you, where to get your information, and just where to find help, resources for finding a registered dietitian. And more often than not, it is covered by insurance. A lot of people don't realize that, and a lot of hospitals have very good programs. So thank you so much for spending this time. This is great, and I look forward to further conversations.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for joining me. And if you're looking for more inside information, check out my Substack. Just go to drstryker.substack.com. And you can also follow me on Instagram @drstryke.